This is a CNA podcast.
Welcome to the Heart of the Matter, where we take a deep dive each week into the news that's been most talked about. I'm Jamie Ho. This week on this first podcast, we're talking about e-scooters, PMDs, personal mobility devices, no matter what you call them, they've been in the news lately. Last week, the Singapore government announced new rules for e-scooters, including a minimum age for riders on paths and passing a theory test. And this came after the complete ban of e-scooters from footpaths earlier in November. But will these new rules encourage safe e-scooter use? Or have they reduced us to only behaving when there are only restrictions? Have we even managed to find a fine balance on e-scooter regulations? Or maybe is there even a balance, or at least in the short term? What can we look forward to in the longer term? Here to discuss this with me are three people, very eminently qualified. First, Walter Tessera, the nominated Member of Parliament and Associate Professor of Economics at the Singapore University of Social Sciences. Walter, welcome.
Thank you.
We have Stephen Lim, Safety and Education Vice President at the Singapore Cycling Federation, and he was also a member of the Active Mobility Advisory Panel. Stephen, morning.
Good morning.
And Samuel, a Research Fellow at the Lee Kuan Yew Centre for Innovative Cities at the Singapore University of Technology and Design. Samuel.
Good morning.
Now, let me start with the announcements last week on December 4th. Where the government announced these new restrictions, or at least rules, governing the use of e-scooters on footpaths. Now, Walter, how effective do you think these new rules will be in ensuring the safety of both the riders as well as pedestrians? Because ultimately, I believe that that's what we're looking at. And if you look at both sets of announcements, both in November and December, how do you see us right now?
Well, I think the announcements are really a way for the government to try and calibrate usage of PMDs a bit better. I think the main problem we're facing is that the infrastructure we have in Singapore is not well adapted to the use of PMDs, especially the path network. At the same time, it's also quite dangerous for PMDs to be on the road, which is why they're banned from the road. We don't have, for example, an on-road bicycling path network at all. And road users, motorists, are also not very used to sharing the road anyway, even with bicycles, let alone PMDs, so they can't go there, right? So I think these rules are just ways of trying to calibrate the coexistence of PMDs with other users, whether it's paths, cycling networks, or roads, better. As far as the ban on footpaths is concerned, I think we all know the reasons why we had to ban PMDs from footpaths. It was the ongoing recklessness of the small minority of PMD users on footpaths that caused a lot of widespread public alarm and concern there. In terms of the more recent December announcement, I think there are two parts to that announcement. If I'm not wrong, one part was the age restriction on e-scooter use, and the other part was the announcement of a theory test that would be required for users in the future. I think as far as the age restriction goes, the reason why that's in place is that statistically speaking, there is a quite close link between age and reckless use of transport. Whether that's, you know, motorcycles, cars, anything it is, you tend to find that younger users, statistically speaking, are much more dangerous. And so I think it's not surprising that we've considered an age limit there. What I do have to say, however, is that at least when it comes to motor vehicles, usually the age restrictions only go away at quite an advanced age. For example, when you look at insurance loading typically only starts to go away around the mid-20s or even later than that. So I think it remains to be seen whether 16 is the right age or not to calibrate this rule to, but I think it's a start at least. As far as the theory test goes, of course, tests have been around for motor vehicle licensing for decades, but I think we also recognize that for motor vehicles, you need to go beyond just the theory. You need to look at how people use it in practice. And I think, again, we have to see how effective is this theory test at reducing reckless use. It may make users aware of the fact that there is such a thing as standards for e-scooter and PMD use, but whether it will correct behavior, lead to the right kind of behavior, I think we have to see. And if it doesn't work, then you may even have to consider practical tests the same way that we do for motor vehicle use.
Let me bring Stephen into this conversation, because Walter brings up really good points. And the question then I have is, if you look at it in terms of how they were rolled out, wouldn't it have made a bit more sense to roll out the age restrictions and the theory tests sort of first, as a first step in trying to regulate behavior, as Walter was saying? And then maybe if that didn't work, then move on to the footpath ban as well as happening. But we've seen sort of it reversed a little bit. Since you were on the panel, how did you guys see that process?
Well, the process is that the latest recommendation were actually submitted in September. Right? So, but it didn't come through until December, where they announced that the government accepted all of them. So, but then the ban was in between, right? November, came the ban. Now, the thing is, prior to this, over the years, I think since 2016, when we first liberated the footpath to allow cyclists and PMDs on the footpath, the government approach was to allow the devices or the users to so-called self-regulate and develop.
Precisely.
Right? And then we monitor it closely and then we act accordingly. Mm. So if we look back, then over the years, there were many measures actually rolled out, right? Including lowering the speed and step up the enforcement, that kind of thing. So, but apparently, it doesn't seem
to work
well. So on the question is that, wouldn't it be better to actually come out with this age restriction? So it goes back to the same thing, right? So the measure that if you're going to do age restriction and theory test all this, right, then you need some time to monitor to see what is going to happen. So it may or it may not work. But what the point down here is, the situation is getting critical in a way, I would put it. So we're going to let it roll on another, say, 6 months. And what if another major accident happened, which is what we really do not want to see? So I think, I guess that is why they came to the decision where they decided to act it. That way, to ban it, right? And then later on, they look at it. Because also, the other thing is that we are not banning it completely.
On
so it's just a partial, so-called partial ban, banning it on the footpath. So they are still allowed on other areas, cycling path, shared path. So that means there's still a necessity to come up with such measure. In terms of age, like what Water has said, age, I think, is quite evidence that the age is one of the greater link. So we are coming up with this thing. So that's why.
I mean, it's a good point about that, I suppose. And Samuel, since Stephen raised the point about the cycling paths, clearly they're still allowed there. But the fact of the matter is, it is almost a de facto ban because, let's be truthful about this, the cycling paths and the shared paths are not built for that kind of mobility that we have in mind, or at least the users or the majority of users have in mind, especially for example, the food delivery people. So again, we come to the situation where I think the best of all intentions, you had staggered sort of policy processes, everything went well, they could have done that in that way. But as Stephen said, there was a critical point that we would reach. But what's your take on this, Samuel, from the land planning, urban sort of mobility angle? Where are we now with firstly having to have the government step in at such an urgent point, but infrastructure still lagging behind a little bit?
Firstly, I think we got to know that the writing is already on the wall. In the last few months, we have seen an increase in the number of incidents, the severity of the accidents too. And even personally, in my daily lives, I have a lot of encounters with PMD users. Not everyone is reckless. It's a very small minority of them, but there are some recklessness going on, and pedestrians are also learning how to adapt with them over the last 2 years or so. But we are actually limited by the constraints of the infrastructure that we have. Let's say our footpaths now are slightly more than a meter wide, and it wouldn't even allow two PMDs side by side. What more when you have two pedestrians on both directions, and then you have two PMDs coming? Where do the pedestrians go? Where do the PMDs go? So I don't think we as a society have yet developed a norm in terms of how we interact with the PMDs. And by asking the PMDs to just all move to the road where there's actually more space isn't actually a safe option too. So how do we actually form a norm or a culture where we can coexist together? But I think over the years, where the approach is kind of to allow all these innovative transport modes to come in and to let them to use it as a sandbox to see how Singapore can allow these modes to integrate into our mobility landscape. But I think it has come to a point where probably action has to be taken while the infrastructure is catching up. So we know in the coming years, the transport network will be improved, the cycling pathways will be expanded, but there's a lag time in all of this. There are also other issues in place here that we see currently today. For example, how would you know a cycling path is a cycling path? So in different districts, we have different types of cycling paths. So how would one, how would someone know whether this is a cycling path or whether it's just an expanded footpath? So I think education is needed for not only the PMD users, but also for the pedestrians. So one of the recommendations in the report was to educate pedestrians also. So for example, do you keep left or do you keep right? So when a PMD or bicycle is coming, you keep left. Okay? Unless you're overtaking like a vehicle should, then you overtake on the right. But generally, you keep to the left of the path. So you form kind of a norm on the road where you can coexist together with other modes of transport.
There was some talk as well about what the responsibilities if again there are any, because there was some blowback on this of as far as the pedestrians are concerned, as to what are the roles, norms that pedestrians need to adapt to. Of course, pedestrians will be slightly aggrieved to feel as if they should adapt to any sort of norms. But Stephen, when you were thinking through all this, again, it goes back to the point about evolving social norms and behavior, which unfortunately always seem to lag behind. As far as this was concerned, did you foresee any need for pedestrians themselves to be better educated, to be more aware? Or, you know, was it always going to be a case that pedestrians sort of felt that footpaths were primarily their domain?
Yes, of course. You see, the thing that is that we always say is that safety is a personal responsibility. But once you're out there on the road, on the footpaths, on the public place, safety becomes a shared responsibility. So it cannot be a one-sided thing, right? So I understand where some of the people are coming from, that it's named footpath or pedestrian walkway. So by right, as a pedestrian should have all the rights, right? Actually, not wrong, and nothing changed there.
Not wrong, but not complete.
Right? There's nothing. It's just like Samuel had brought up something like that. There's a need to create this social norm so that people know exactly how to behave. It's just like years ago, we started this campaign or this move that says, hey, when you're on an escalator, you keep left, right? So you don't block the way, that kind of thing. So it's the same. Perhaps we want to put it the other way. It's like I'm using a very day-to-day example. We have the rights to walk into any hawker center, and we have the freedoms to sit anywhere without having worry to say not being served, right? So you have the rights, you have the freedom. But that doesn't equal to you can do things freely. So you can't just do things that potentially will affect the person next to you or even hurt the person next to you. So if you bring this back, it's the same as on the footpath. You have the rights, you have the freedom to be there, but that doesn't mean you can do things freely, which is it doesn't have to be pedestrian against PMDs. And in fact, on the road situation or this path situation, it's never me versus you. So I think we will come across such example. Even as a pedestrian, when you are walking, you are being blocked by pedestrian in front of you. I mean, so engrossed in their conversation or looking at the phones, that kind of thing. So it doesn't have to be pedestrian against PMDs. It can be pedestrian and pedestrian. So what we are trying to do here is like what Samuel said, to use that code of conduct to create a social norm where people know and understand how do you behave in a certain place, right? So it's like, it's not a rule. So in the hawker center, no smoking is a rule. But to return the tray is a code of conduct so that you clean after your meal and then don't affect another person. So that's how the things go.
I mean, intellectually, I think most people would agree with you. But if I was to sort of put myself in the position of the pedestrian, and I'm a regular pedestrian with my dog every evening, the perception that they will have is that was the status quo. The status quo was, it is a footpath. This is my rightful place where I can feel safe. Old folk can feel safe. But there was a change to the status quo. And the change to the status quo happened so quickly that there was no time for either policy to evolve, infrastructure to evolve, or behavior to evolve. So that's where the conflicts came in. So the question then now is, obviously, policy had to come in very, very quickly, faster than anyone had hoped. Infrastructure can't keep up. And hopefully, behavior will sort of follow after you have all this. And that's where I think, since you raised the code of conduct, hopefully that will change things even faster.
Or maybe I will just put it in the other way. Okay, so when you mentioned that you are talking about on the footpath, I have the right of way, isn't it? So if I were to transfer that to on the road, I think when you cross, as a pedestrian, when you cross a zebra crossing or the traffic light control junction, when it's green man, you have the right of way by rules, right? But having that right of way doesn't mean you apply the right of way there and there as a user. And then you can start crossing the zebra crossing without even looking.
Okay.
Right? I'm sure if you get into an accident, you will win the case in court because of right-of-way rules. But right-of-way rules is not for user to apply there and there. It's for the authority to apply the right-of-way rules when they need to determine the case who is wrong. Right? So put it that way, that if you're going to do that and you get knocked down by a vehicle, if you're injured, you're injured. It's unfortunately, if you're gone, too bad.
Doesn't matter what the rules were.
Yeah, it doesn't matter whether you win the case in court or not. So that's what, you know, we have been trying to advocate, that, you know, you do not apply the right of way rule as a user when you are there. Right? You still have to look out. So that is where the shared responsibility comes in. So likewise, on the footpath, you can carry on your daily life, whatever you're doing always on the footpath. But it's just that you have to take a little precaution, look out with your environment, any danger that is coming, right? So
yeah, that's the fundamental point in terms of larger social behavior and norms. And maybe I bring Walter into this to take a bit of a bigger picture look at it as well. In that, if you go back to the previous big sort of land transport controversy, or little controversy, was over the bike sharing and all the bikes that were for a while they were everywhere. And again, the whole issue of social norms and behavior came up, and that people were leaving it all over the place, and then the government had to come in. And now they've more or less gone, but they're slowly coming back. As an economist, Walter, as a sort of an academic looking at this in terms of economic behavior, economic choice, is it always going to be like this, especially now that innovation, technological advances happen so quickly that not only can policy not keep up, social behavior can't keep up? And then in this balance, where are we going to find the need for... Because I can foresee the government doesn't want to be in a position where it's always trying to keep up and trying to intervene. Right. So where are we at? Because it's going to happen again, I suppose, at some form of technological advance or things like that.
You know, it's interesting you brought up the example of bike sharing, because I think it illustrates what the limits of social behavior or social adaptation are. Yeah. And that's when basically the market kind of run amok, you see.
Yeah.
I mean, if you compare bike sharing today to, you know, maybe about 1-2 years ago, you'll notice the big difference, of course, is that it's not nearly anywhere near the same type of problem as it was 2 years ago. But there's a very simple reason for that. It's because the bike sharing companies have run out of money to just dump bikes into the street. And the volume of bikes in the street has fallen dramatically, even though we have, of course, implemented QR code parking. I think the fact is, with the much reduced volume of bikes on the street, even if we didn't have a QR code parking system, it would be much less of a social issue. It was a social issue primarily, I think, because the bike sharing companies threw so many bikes on the street that even if most or the vast majority of users had been responsible, you'd still have bikes all over the place blocking your way. I mean, that was the reality of the situation. Yeah. And I think with PMDs, it's the same case, you know. Social adaptation behavior, we could have adapted to a small number of PMDs, but because PMDs were such an attractive option for so many commuters, not to mention they single-handedly supported the food delivery industry, that just put a lot of PMD users into conflict with people on a constant basis, on a daily basis, and it was very hard for all of us to adapt to that. But you know, on the issue of adaptation, I think there's another point to think about here, and that's the interplay between behavior and between infrastructure and design. And it's not a straightforward issue. So let me illustrate what I mean by thinking about the road network, okay? The rules that we have on the road in Singapore. We have a very well-engineered road system, and part of the intent behind designing the road system is to separate car users, motorists, from pedestrians and slower-moving traffic. And we've achieved, we've achieved this to quite a great extent in Singapore, because when you're driving down the road, you generally don't have to worry too much about pedestrians getting in your way and things like that, because we've very carefully separated them from the road network. This is not true, by the way, if you were to go to less developed countries, yes, for example, in Southeast Asia, where the road network is poorly designed and pedestrians are getting in your way all the time because there's no option for them. But in Singapore, because we've designed it so carefully, motorists can speed on the road without worrying about pedestrians suddenly coming up in front of them. And you couldn't quite do this if you were driving in many other cities in Southeast Asia. So by design, we've encouraged motorists to not worry about other potential users of the space. Because of that, we've encouraged motorists to some extent to not worry too much about taking care, you know? And there's an opposing view of infrastructure design that is espoused in some other countries, where the idea is, instead of separating motorists so much, why not integrate them a bit more and let them know that this is a shared space, so that they will have to get used to the idea that people can suddenly be appearing in front of them, to get them to slow down and be more aware. So, you know, when you think about PMDs, footpaths, and so on, I think there's a legitimate question here. What kind of design are we looking for? Are we looking for a design where we separate PMDs from footpath users quite rigorously, but in the process, we may give both sides an entitlement mentality? So, you know, when a PMD user is on a PMD or cycle path, their mentality is, I can speed on this, I don't worry about pedestrians. And vice versa, when pedestrians are on a footpath, their mentality is, I can do whatever I want, I don't need to worry about bicycles. Is that what we want to go for? Or do we want to instead go for a true integrated mixed, you know, kind of concept where both sides view each other as being legitimate users? Because right now, I don't think we have that.
So that's an excellent point, because not only is it the way that you've pointed it out, and this is where I'll bring Samuel in, because it can't be that with every new sort of entrant, you build infrastructure around it as well, because that in and of itself is not sustainable, because it can be bicycles, it can be e-scooters, it can be e-bikes. How do you separate them as well? And it cannot be that infrastructure is always trying to keep up with advances. And don't forget what happened to walking as well, because at one stage in this first mile, last mile endeavor, we built a lot of covered walkways, and covered walkways were primarily meant for people who walked. So when you look at all of this in the big picture, it's how the country is set up, how our infrastructure is set up. Where is sort of a sustainable balance where you can find, as Walter said, some norms of behavior where everything can be shared, that infrastructure doesn't always have to be built to meet new demand. Where are we at if we were to look at it from that perspective, Samuel?
So I think there are two questions over here that we need to ask ourselves. The first one is, do we want a transport system or mobility landscape in Singapore that is receptive to mobility innovations, whatever it might be in the next 5 or 10 years? So whatever is being introduced, what are the new innovations people are generally accepting, and we would look forward to integrating it into whatever we have existingly. So we have seen this previously with the bike sharing, where it was a disruptive innovation. Now we see it with the use of the proliferation of PMDs, which is another disruption just a couple of years after the bike sharing. So we have not really managed to integrate it well. But if we ask ourselves in the whole land transport master plan, do we view all these new innovative mobility options as legitimate options? Do we want to integrate them and provide them as part of mobility options for everyone? So PMDs are not just designed to deliver your food, but PMDs are there to actually help with your first mile and last mile, as you mentioned earlier. It could be very useful, especially with the well-established infrastructure within the neighborhoods, particularly when the neighborhood connectors and the cycling paths are widened or established, right? So it really provides you with another very low-cost, affordable and very effective first mile, last mile options for someone that is able to use. And also, not to mention, you do not really have to build any infrastructure in the HDB blocks, because you will bring your bike and then bring it back home and you charge it there. It really solves some transportation challenges for the general population. So that holds the potential. But do we view this as a legitimate growing option? So that's the first question. The second one is to ask, how can we actually create a more gracious society, not only for integrating the transport mode, but in general? I know we have this kiasu mentality, right?
So yeah, we've been talking about gracious society for the, I don't know, 3 or 4 decades now. Yes. It must be, right?
Exactly. So we had this Single Lion, and I remember back in school, and even now they still do it. You go to East Coast Park when you're in primary school, you spend a few hours there in the traffic park, really learning the rules, but once you enter the real world, the rules don't really apply.
You see, that's the problem, because as we have sort of, we spoke about earlier in the conversation, it appears that behaviors will never keep up, and the government and this government will feel the need, as it has in this particular case, to intervene, and in this case specifically intervene quite unexpectedly and quickly to meet, as you say, a critical point, Stephen, just now. I want to close this off. Now that we are in this position, do we expect any further regulatory sort of tweaks? Are we in a comfortable, steady state as far as e-scooters are concerned? Or is there some more tweaks that we can look at? And also, are there sort of larger, big picture tweaks that we can look forward to regulate new entrants? Because there are known unknowns as well in terms of what can happen, because it's now e-scooters, it could be something else later on. And bicycles are something which we've always tried to encourage. So specific to e-scooters, are we sort of okay now? I was expecting at some point maybe insurance or some form of other stricter registration. Are we going to go down there for these devices? And apart from these devices, what else do you think can be done? So maybe Walter, close us off, you know, for your views.
So I think worldwide, regulation, you know, of e-scooters, PMDs, all these emerging devices, the state of regulation is still very much in its infancy, because I think these devices have only become commercially widespread and successful within the last couple of years. And honestly, I think Singapore, everywhere, every jurisdiction is struggling to come to terms of how to regulate and think about them. And to put this in perspective, I want to remind everybody that, you know, when we look at the road network today, motor vehicles, you know, it's easy to make the mistake mistake of thinking that it was obvious when motor vehicles were first invented how to regulate and license them as well as their users, but it wasn't obvious at all. It took a couple of decades for the first motor driver licensing schemes to actually be invented, and it took even more years after that for the idea of practical tests and certification of drivers to actually come about.
Even seatbelts,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, seatbelts. I mean, seatbelts took almost 100 years to, you know, get into place. And if you think about things like insurance regulations, standards for construction design, all of that took decades and decades for any authorities to even think, should this be something that we have a business doing? So when it comes to you know, e-scooters, PMDs, and so on, I do expect that if they become a much more integral part of the transport system, whether in Singapore or elsewhere, we will see standardizations come about for things such as construction, design, safety, and so on. I would expect that the major countries manufacturing or using these, especially China, would find it in their own interest to develop some kind of national standardization scheme for at least some of these construction and engineering aspects. Because I think without that, you're going to find it increasingly hard to get these products exported or used in other jurisdictions, I think. So I think if you look at motor vehicles as a guide, I expect that many of the same principles could be coming into place simply because I think the industry would have a self-interest in making sure that they don't get regulated out of existence. So I think that's what we're going to see.
Great point. Stephen, what's your take on that? Will that be a good outcome that we should all try and accelerate towards?
Yeah, but first of all, I think if you ask, it's like, are we going to see more regulation coming up? I believe we will. And matter of fact, it's part of the role of AMAP, the panel, to actually constantly look at the developments and then make recommendations to the government. So, and like Walter said, I think all these sort of things will evolve, right? And once, when I was on a radio program together with SBS BM King, he mentioned something very interestingly, that back then, when car was first invented, pedestrian were fighting the space with cars. So if back then we had banned the car, what is going to be in the world today? So I think that's the thing. So we have to sometimes let things develop, evolve, and then we have to then monitor it closely and then make changes. So it doesn't have to be e-scooter. I mean, looking at the technology, it can be something else, right? So we just have to keep looking at the things. And also this e-scooter thing is a world phenomenon. I think many countries were caught. It came too fast, too furious. Many were caught. Yeah. So we are still struggling to look at how, you know, like many other countries, how can we regulate this or and still allow it to develop. So I guess, yes, I think we are going to see more rules, more changes coming. It's just part and parcel of changes evolving.
Okay, Simon, what's on your wish list then if that's the case?
So I think Singapore has a unique opportunity here to take the lead. And given our size and what we have done so far, we really can take the lead in trying to establish standards, trying to establish a whole suite of policies that is complementary to fostering the development of new mobility innovations, and yet at the same time maintaining a harmonious and really smart city where technology really work together with the people, the citizens. And I think different countries have taken different approaches. There's no one right approach, but I think we can find a way that will make it uniquely Singapore.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. We had Walter, Sarah, Stephen, Samuel. Thank you so much. This has been Heart of the Matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.